It's 2:06.
I'm Pat Morrison. You can call it a land rush. You can call it a gold rush because it's a little bit of both. The Bureau of Land Management manages about 11 million acres in Southern California. Now, all of a sudden, a million acres of that is being targeted by interests that want to use it to generate solar, geothermal, and wind power. In 2 years, California has a goal of getting 20% of its power from renewable sources. And so the rush is on by companies who want to set up their operations and Bureau of Land Management land in order to supply the need for that renewable energy. Environmentalists and off-roaders have sided together to oppose some of this. We'll be talking about that. But first, we're joined by Steve Borchard, who is the director of the Bureau of Land Management's California Desert District. Mr. Borchard, thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Pat.
It sounds like you have just been inundated with an unexpected flow of applications for BLM land for these renewable energy sources and uses.
We do have a lot of interest in lands that we manage here in Southern California. We've had about 74 applicants come in and talk to us about solar energy, and about 66 applicants come in and talk to us about wind energy.
And how does that compare to, say, 2 or 3 years ago?
Well, 2 or 3 years ago, we have people talking to us about wind energy, but 2 or 3 years ago, we had not spoken with anyone about solar. I think our first solar applicant came in November of 2005.
What is the status of this land? Who's allowed to use it and for what purposes? It is public land. Is it available to make private money from?
Yes, it is. BLM is a multiple-use agency. We manage about 260 million acres of land surface nationwide here in Southern California, just under 11 million acres. The lands that BLM manages have a long history of being available for mineral extraction, livestock grazing, coal, oil and gas, recreation, a lot of different uses as our mandate from Congress directs us to do.
Of the million acres that some of these companies are looking to use for solar or geothermal or wind energy, what is its status? Is some of it reserved as an environmental preserve? Is some of it purely recreational?
We manage lands here in Southern California that are allocated for a variety of uses. However, most, if not all, of the land that is being looked at for solar is not reserved for any other specific use. For example, we manage 69 wilderness areas in Southern California, covering about 3.3 million acres, another 350,000 acres in wilderness study areas. We have steered applicants away from those areas. We also manage about 3.1 million acres of desert wildlife management areas. Those are areas we've specifically set aside or allocated for critical habitat for the desert tortoise. We have no solar applications in those areas.
Would you entertain them if you did, or are these places strictly off limits?
We have advised applicants not to apply for those areas, and we will not entertain solar applications in desert wildlife management areas.
You've gotten so many of these that I guess you've called for a timeout, at least on the solar applications, and you're going to start public meetings this month to assess the impact?
Yes, we are. Starting next week on the 16th, we'll have a public meeting in Riverside, and then on the 17th, we'll have one in Barstow, and then I think on the 20th, we have one in Sacramento where we'll be doing what's called a public scoping, where we invite the public and interested stakeholders and anyone else that wants to come express scoping comments on this new programmatic EIS that we've initiated that will not only cover California, it will cover five other states, Nevada, Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico.
Have your counterparts in those states also been inundated with applications from solar and wind and geothermal companies?
Nevada, I believe, has 26 solar applications and numerous wind applications. I think Arizona has about 23 applications. Colorado has one, and New Mexico might have three. I think we've got about 130 solar applications across all six states.
Already, as you say, on some of the land that the Bureau manages, there are mines being run, there are timber harvesting and other activities. How much money comes to the federal government for these uses?
Under solar, revenues would come at a lease rate. The land would be leased to fair market value, if private lands were leased for solar production would be appraised, and that's what we would receive. Under timber, timber is sold through a public bidding process, and we receive funds that way, where bidders bid.
So the taxpayers do get something for the companies that come in and make money on federal land?
Oh, yes. Each commodity has specific laws that govern how the taxpayers receive a fair market value for the either mineral or value natural resource that's taken off the land. In fact, BLM is one of the two federal agencies that actually turns a profit in rents and royalties from marketing commodities and natural resources across the country. I think BLM pulls in about $3 billion a year.
Mr. Borchardt, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Stephen Borchardt directs the Bureau of Land Management's California Desert District, which has been inundated with applications to use BLM land, about 1 million acres of it, to set up solar and geothermal and wind power facilities. Stuart Hemphill is vice president of renewable and alternative power at Southern California Edison, which is working with Sterling Energy Systems to set up a solar farm in the Mojave Desert. Mr. Hemphill, thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
So what was the genesis of this project, and how big is it?
Well, it's one of many projects that we've undertaken. We contract for power with the largest purchaser in the country of renewable energy sources, and this was one of our early contracts. We have since signed three additional solar contracts, and so you're going back to the Sterling project. It was something that came out of our 2003 competitive solicitation for renewable power. It's 500 megawatts, and just to put things in perspective, since you were talking to the Bureau of Land Management, the typical rule of thumb is about 5 acres per megawatt. So for a 500 megawatt project, that's about 2,500 acres of
land.
And
how much energy is a megawatt?
Well, it depends on the technology, but a megawatt would produce it would probably serve about 650 homes in California.
So multiply that times 500.
It's pretty big.
Now, why now, and why work with some of these other private energy companies instead of setting up your own solar farm?
Well, there are many companies that are out there that are employing new technologies. I think in the solar arena, it's too early to tell which technologies will be successful. So, I mean, if Southern California Edison was out doing only its own projects, we would be betting on one or maybe two technologies at a time when many of them are still in their infancy. So this is about not putting all of your eggs in one basket. And there are plenty of private developers who are willing to take on the technology risk associated with the new solar technologies.
Mr. Hemphill, solar has been around for a while, so has wind power. Why all of a sudden is there an interest? Is there a new profit factor in this that has just emerged?
Well, there is a renewable portfolio standard in the state of California and in 25 other states, which is written into state law. It sets goals for the state, and the goal in California is that 20% of energy be produced by renewable sources. And so now solar has been around since the 1950s, but that's been photovoltaic solar. And then the other project that we've had since the 1980s has been what's called parabolic trough. But that's the only one that's been in the United States. It's been operating for 20 years. And the technologies that we're seeing today are very different than what we've historically seen.
So are these companies convinced there's money to be made?
Oh, yes.
And why this land? Why this federal government land?
Well, it's the best solar resource is out in the desert, and that's where the Bureau of Land Management holds the land. So it's an available source. The developers are typically looking for large quantities of land that is potentially usable for their type of project, and they also want to make sure it's nearby transmission lines so it can be delivered to customers here in Southern California.
Is Southern California Edison helping companies negotiate the paperwork? It takes about $200,000 to go through the application process at the Bureau of Land Management.
No, that's something that the developers themselves typically do. So we sign contracts with them that helps them make their case that they need the land. They also can go to the bank and get financing. So our main purpose is to work with them, find a contract that is beneficial for our customers so that the developers can finish the rest of the job.
So you contract with them so they show that they've got a market for what it is they're going to be creating. How much of what you are hoping to supply is solar, and how soon can you get it online?
Well, that's a really good question. About 5% of our customers' demand comes from solar today. We actually buy 90% of the nation's solar and have for the last 20 years. The big question is which of these technologies will be successful in getting up and running, and hopefully all of them. And over the long haul, it's hard to know how many of these will be successful and be able to produce, over 20 years.
So this is like drilling 10 wells and hoping that one or two are going to come in.
Well, I hope it's a little bit more. Hope it's a little bit more certain than that. I think all of the technologies, the ones that I've seen that have been contracting with the utilities in California so far, have been very promising technologies. So the question is, will they be economic over the long haul, and will they have any challenges in terms of development and maintenance over 20 years?
And this is what you're looking to fulfill that 20% renewable by 2010 in California?
It's one of many. We also buy geothermal, wind, hydro, biomass, a total of five different major technologies and a lot of sub-technologies within it.
All right, we're talking about the fact that there is a land rush and a gold rush for land in federal hands right now to try to set up solar, geothermal, and other renewable energies. This is 89.3 KPCC. We'll have a little more energy about energy when we come back.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Los Angeles Film Festival. This summer in Westwood Village, June 19th to June 29th, the festival will screen more than 100 feature films. The International Showcase introduces audiences to new cinema from France, South Africa, Iceland, Denmark, China, South Korea, Iran, and more. Tickets are available at lafilmfest.com. The Los Angeles Film Festival, where the audience is king.
This is 89.3 KPCC, online at kpcc.org. A real estate partnership that owns 15,000 acres of undeveloped land in the Santa Clarita Valley has filed for bankruptcy. LandSource Communities Development is more than $1 billion in debt. Its main investor, the California Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS. CalPERS spokeswoman Pat Mock says the land deal represents less than 1% of the giant pension fund's investment portfolio.
This particular investment does not have a material effect on our fund. It's one of thousands of investments that we make. Some investments may not produce tremendous yields, while on those same days, other investments receive better than expected returns.
CalPERS is the nation's largest public employees pension fund. It says it'll wait and see what happens while LandSource tries to restructure its debt. It's 2:21.
LA's first Major League Baseball team was very nearly the Los Angeles Senators, but a cocktail napkin changed the baseball landscape forever.
I got a little note that said, "I want to see you when I come to Los Angeles. I'm interested." Senator Walter O'Malley.
Hi, I'm Kitty Feldy. We'll continue the story of how the Brooklyn Dodgers became the Los Angeles Dodgers Tuesday, right here on 89.3 KPCC.
I'm Pat Morrison. There's a land rush in federal desert lands as companies interested in solar and geothermal try to get a foot in the door, a foot in the desert, to set up their operations on federal land. Stuart Hemphill is Vice President of Renewable and Alternative Power at Southern California Edison, working with Sterling Energy Systems to construct a huge solar farm in the Mojave Desert, capable of generating about 500 megawatts of power. Mr. Hemphill, you mentioned a variety of solar techniques. Are you going to be trying all of them out there if you get the go-ahead from the Bureau of Land Management to see which is the most effective?
Well, I wouldn't say that we're trying all of them. Southern California Edison has, I think three technologies that we've looked at, but there are other utilities that are also purchasing solar power out in the same desert area. So Pacific Gas and Electric, our northern utility, Northern California utility, has also been purchasing power. So far, three different technologies.
Mr. Hemphill, have you done your own environmental assessment as to the impact of a massive solar footprint in the desert?
No, we haven't. You know, we contract with the developers, and it's up to them to do the environmental surveys.
And what is the schedule, as you know of it right now, with the public hearings coming up and when this system might be up and running?
I have not spoken with Sterling recently. We expect that they will keep up their part of the contractual bargain. So we will expect, you know, some deliveries in the early of next decade.
Next decade being only a couple of years away.
2010, yeah.
Okay. It sounds so far away when you say it the other
way. Oh, well, I probably should have clarified.
Mr. Hemphill, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Stuart Hemphill is the Vice President of Renewable and Alternative Power at Southern California Edison, working with Sterling Energy Systems to set up a huge solar farm in the Mojave Desert that would require the approval of the Bureau of Land Management because it is federal land. Because it is federal land, there are concerns both from environmentalists and recreationalists, if I can call them that, about how this land is going to be used, how it may be taken away from its current uses. Terry Wehner is Conservation Coordinator for the Desert Protective Council. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, I'm happy to be on today.
What are your concerns about the number of applications that are coming in to use this federal land and what its impact might be?
Well, we have a number of concerns, and our group, the Desert Protective Council, has been working on desert protection issues since for the last 50 years. And the trend is that whatever projects we would prefer not to do in our own backyard, or in this case on our rooftops, we look at the desert. There's still an awful lot of people who do not appreciate the desert for the intricate, marvelous ecosystem that it is. And so they say, let's just look at the public lands. It's a lot cheaper for the developers to put the projects out there, and it's the path of least resistance because we have, across the country, we could use a larger following of people who understand the desert. But out here in California, there are plenty of us who enjoy the desert for many, many uses, and the Bureau of Land Management does the best job they can managing their land for multiple uses. In addition to taking applications for all types of projects which seriously exploit the desert resources, they also have to protect people's need. And I do think in our current culture of rushy rush and noise and light pollution in the cities, we need places of refuge, places where we can go and get out of our cars and look at the stars and go, ah, solitude. And there are other types of recreational uses, too. And people love to go to the desert in the springtime and see the flowers. We have the desert, the Mojave Desert, as the home to our state reptile, the desert tortoise, which, by the way, right now isn't doing all that well. One of the main impacts that has been brought to light lately of large industrial solar farms on the desert is the fact that these massive projects don't just put up little panels from place to place. They scrape the entire desert down. There's soil in the desert, And some of the soils are called biological crusts. They're coverings to the soil that contain microbial creatures that protect the land from blowing away and also harbor nutrients. Recently, we read a report. It's in a journal called Nature Reports. The study was on climate change, and the study states that the carbon stored in the desert soil may be easily as much as carbon stored in some temperate forest.
So the damage to desert soil might release as much carbon and contribute to global warming as cutting down trees in the Amazon rainforest.
This is a good point, and we wouldn't go cutting down our forest to put up solar panels.
I'd like to ask you about the fact, as you mentioned, the desert ecosystem is very fragile, and not a lot of people see it to appreciate it for what it is. What kind of trade-offs are there, though, for renewable energy and the need for renewable energy versus these ecosystems?
Well, this is a very good question on your part. The way a lot of conservation groups see it, and individuals and cities, by the way, is that we need to look at what we can do before we go to the extreme of raiding the desert for places. We haven't at all maximized energy efficiency in the cities. We have rooftop solar possibilities. And we have the possibility of, you know, parking lots and hospitals and schools and putting photovoltaic installations up there to supply quite a bit of our energy. In fact, I'm sure that our friend from Southern California Edison would be able to tell you much more than I could about a project that they announced in March, whereby they've invested, I don't know, 800-some-odd million dollars in photovoltaic solar equipment on commercial buildings in Southern California, which will produce 250 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 162,000 homes. Now, the interesting thing about this is Edison said its move was possible because the cost of solar technology on rooftops has recently been cut in half.
Well, Ms. Wehner, one of the points that was made was that it is cheaper, certainly, for companies to go out into federal land than to try to acquire, even on a lease basis, commercial land in places like the cities.
That is questionable with what they're learning, the companies are learning about the cost of this new thin film photovoltaic, which has brought the cost down. Perhaps they will have to make deals with people who own the buildings, but we need to incentivize, which would be another thing we could do, this type of activity, to make it more cost friendly to all involved than going out and raiding the public lands. When the solar comes in on 2,500 acres, everything else goes out. The flat-tail horned lizard, the off-road vehicle recreation, the bird watchers and the hikers are all banned from that piece of land. And Steve Borchard mentioned all the important desert areas that are going to be protected from proposals, but there's a lot of other desert areas that are important to the integrity of the system that will be affected by this.
It's not usual that environmentalists find themselves on the same side as off-roaders, who they criticize for being destructive of the desert terrain. Why are you on the same side in this case, and is this not a little bit of uneasy political bedfellows for you?
Well, not at all. You know, we, especially with the Desert Protective Council, try to work in coalitions with as many groups we can, and we're not the off-road vehicle recreation is certainly one of the most ongoing damaging recreations in the desert. However, they have some places that all have agreed are their places to use these vehicles, and they, in order to prevent, you know, going all over the desert, they need to have these places kept for their use.
Ms. Wehner, is your group, are numbers of groups like you going to be showing up at these hearings on the environmental impact and the possibility of putting in these large solar and geothermal farms when the hearings begin? Will you be showing up there?
Yeah, absolutely. That's really important for us to comment and make sure the BLM covers all the possible impacts that could be brought about by this, and we'll encourage our constituents and the people in the cities to attend the meetings, too.
Terry Wehner, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Terry Wehner is Conservation Coordinator for the Desert Protective Council. It's joined with groups, including off-roaders, to express their concerns about the massive rush of proposals to develop solar and geothermal and wind farms in desert areas under the control of the Bureau of Land Management, about 1 million acres in Southern California being targeted for use with these renewable energies. I'm Pat Morrison. In March, after the statements by Barack Obama's minister became public, the notorious tapes now about God damn America, Barack Obama gave a speech that was widely hailed as a breakthrough for race relations. But now, Juan Williams, in a piece in the Wall Street Journal, has taken Barack Obama to the woodshed and saying he needs to deliver another speech, one that is specific and on point to Barack Obama's own personal issues about race. Juan Williams joins me now. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
And, of course, you know Juan is a political analyst for National Public Radio and for Fox News. Well, you really did take him to the woodshed in this piece today.
Well, I mean, the point to me is, look, let's get in front of the race issue. I think it's just so important, beyond politics in this sense, that America, because so many people have so much invested in Barack Obama, realize that race is going to be part of this discussion. And Barack Obama, if you look at the recent polls since March or so, his favorability ratings have been going down about 8 percentage points. He hasn't won white men since going back to, I guess it's late February, early March, Wisconsin. And his numbers have been taking a particular nosedive among white women. Why is it? What's the one intervening event? It's Reverend Wright. And then there came the speech that you talked about in Philadelphia that was widely hailed. But in that speech, Barack Obama never says, you know, I was wrong to sit in those pews for 20 years. He never takes any personal responsibility. He says very lofty things like we should have more conversations about race in America, but he doesn't start with himself. And I think that's why the issue lingers for him as we see the likes of this Father Flager character come dancing across the stage like he's some kind of minstrel, you know, saying, you know, God's greatest. The greatest sin against God is America itself. That stuff just drags down Barack Obama and drags down the aspirations of the first black person with a chance to be president of this country.
The piece appeared Friday in the Wall Street Journal, Juan Williams writing that Mr. Obama's strategies for dealing with the racial demagogues in his past have failed. Is that what you draw from the numbers in his polling, that that people still have questions, still have concerns that he has not adequately addressed?
Exactly right. I mean, if you know, it's so easy to simply say that people have concerns with a black candidate and a reluctance to vote for a black candidate. It's more difficult and I think necessarily nuanced to say they have trouble with a young man that they're coming to know, and they have questions about his judgment, his character, and when they look into his past, what pops up writ large is the likes of Reverend Wright and Father Flager, and he's never quite explained why he was in association with people who would say, God damn America, you know, who would say that the government is spreading AIDS among black people without any basis for saying so. And so if he wants to get ahead of all the likely critics come the fall, Republicans who are seeking, you know, to compete with him for the power of the White House, he needs to, I think, explain why he was there and, if, in my opinion, say, you know what, I sinned. I played racial politics. I was trying to come up on the south side of Chicago, and I was a biracial kid from Hawaii. I didn't have any roots in that community. Reverend Wright did, Trinity Church does, Father Flager does, and so I associated with these people for the benefit of their credentials and their roots to boost myself. But, you know, I was wrong, and now it's time to move on, and I'm asking you to see me as a unifier, as someone who is interested in bringing people together, even though I, like most Americans, have dirty hands when it comes to race relations. I think that would be an inspiring speech, get headlines, and I think it would, in many ways, allow people to say, you know what, here's someone who has moved beyond his past.
What do you think? Should Barack Obama give another speech about race to get out in front of this, to preempt the advertising images that Juan Williams refers to in his Wall Street Journal piece? Give us a call at 866-893-5722. Or did his speech in March address all questions for you? 866-893-KPCC is the number. Juan, is there a danger that the more he talks about this, the more trouble he could get himself into?
Well, in some ways, you know, if you look at the history, and it's so interesting, Barack Obama did not talk about race before that speech in Philadelphia. The reason was that his political advisors said, you know, we don't want to be defined as the black candidate in the race. Remember that his base, as he began this contest and all the way through Iowa, his base was with upper-class whites, intellectuals, and college students. It wasn't until after Iowa, and to some extent even after his very close finish in New Hampshire, that the black community then rallied to him because they saw that he had the ability to attract white voters and could win. So Barack Obama, even at that juncture, was still never talking about race. It was only when it was forced on him. So when you ask me, well, you know, could it be that, you know, it would cause, just stir up more trouble if he spoke about it? No, I think that what we know from American history is that when we don't talk about it, when we don't get in front of it, that's when race really comes back and then pops up in almost like, you know, the devil within. We can't anticipate where it's going to pop up or what it might do. But if we can get in front of it, deal with it constructively, and I think Barack Obama, because he's such a special candidate, has the opportunity, the capacity to do it, I think it's to his benefit.
Juan, how do you see a campaign based on some of these racial issues shaping up, the one you say he needs to get out in front of? What kind of swift voting, if that's indeed what you anticipate, what kind of swift voting do you see out on the horizon working itself into ad spots even now?
Well, we've already seen there were three key congressional races recently, and in two of them we saw ads run that tried to link Barack Obama to the Democratic candidate, and they failed. But in North Carolina, even the state Republican Party ran ads linking a Democratic candidate to Barack Obama and to Reverend Wright and the like. They, you know, had them morph into one. Going into the fall, you can see more of these independent expenditure groups referred to as 527s coming to the fore, more tape of Reverend Wright, more tape of Father Flager, again linking them to Barack Obama. I think you're going to see some even more explicit stuff as you go back into the history of Barack Obama's relationship with people in the Weather Underground and the like. And it's going to just, I fear, if it's not going to be outwardly racist, it's going to have lots of racially loaded language, code language in it. You remember the famous ad from Jesse Helms, two white hands crumpling some paper and saying, you would have had that job, but they had to give it to the black and all this kind of thing. This is just awful stuff, but I don't think there's any way to get around it when we have the first black person in position to be president of the United States. We know that about 8% of whites tell pollsters will not vote for an African-American. You can imagine there are many more who won't even tell the pollster.
All right, Juan Williams, we'll come back with more about your advice to Obama on another speech about race to put some of these issues to rest. 866-893-5722 for your calls as well. This is 89.3 KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by Pacific Symphony Pops. In time for the launch of Mamma Mia, the movie, Pacific Symphony presents ABBA, the hits, this Thursday through Saturday at the Orange County Performing Arts Center. You can hear all-time favorite ABBA songs performed live by the Swedish tribute band Waterloo. They'll be dancing in the aisles. Tickets and information at 714-755-5799 or pacificsymphony.org.
Programming is supported by the California Association of Professional Scientists, representing 3,000 state scientists protecting public health, the environment, and California's natural resources. Information at calscientists.org.
This is 89.3 KPCC, traffic and weather at kpcc.org. Well, come July 1st, you won't be able to hold a cell phone to your ear while driving. California Highway Patrol Commissioner Joe Farrow.
Holding it in your hand, you now become a one-armed driver. Then you have a conversation, and some of these conversations can be quite involved. We'll all have to say there was a time where you were on the phone, you realized, gosh darn, you know, where am I or what just happened? Because you're now devoting all your time and effort to conversing on a telephone call rather than really doing the task at hand, which is driving.
Faro estimates that cell phone distractions cause accidents that injure or kill hundreds of people every year. You'll still be allowed to pick up the cell phone to call someone, but you can't hold it while talking. People under 18 won't be able to use cell phones at all while driving. If you don't have a hands-free device, you might want to check out the website www.freeheadset.org. In Torrance right now on the 405 South at Western, a car has overturned in the carpool and left lanes, and it's jammed from the 105. Hot today, valley highs in the mid-90s, slightly cooler tomorrow and Wednesday, warming up again toward the end of the week. It's 241 at KPCC.
I'm Pat Morrison. You know Juan Williams is a political analyst for National Public Radio and Fox News. In the Wall Street Journal last Friday, he said that Barack Obama needs to make another speech to deal with race to get out ahead of the criticism that surely is coming. He has to admit to sins of using race for political expediency. He has to be honest about real problems at the heart of today's racial divide, including out-of-wedlock births, crime, drugs, and a culture that devalues education, and to raise the bar for how political criticism is handled in his camp. Juan, isn't this in a way of impossibility of physics to be both a candidate who addresses racial issues and to be a post-racial candidate?
That's an interesting one. That's very curious to me, Pat. But, you know, it seems to me that if you truly are going to be post-racial, and I think that's what Barack Obama represents in the American mind, he has to be willing to say, here's where I've come in terms of my racial journey. That I want to be identified as an African-American. I have a white mom and a black immigrant dad, but I have done community organizing and work to firmly establish myself in the black community. It's what I chose to be. I've taken on this challenge when it comes to representing the least of these, the minority that has a history of being oppressed in this country and still struggling in many ways. But he has to admit that at times what he has done is play racial politics to his advantage, and now it's come back as people explore his past in the form of Reverend Wright making these outlandish statements. And I think it would just add to his credibility, and I think even his critics would have to say, now here's an honest guy, because he's telling you exactly how his hands got dirty, and he's asking us all to rise up to a different level to see beyond race.
Juan, I know you have to leave us. The speech should be delivered sooner rather than later.
Yeah, because, look, as you point out, Pat, they've got all of these various groups, not just, you know, the McCain campaign, which, is, of course, has got to be very careful because they could quickly be charged with racism, but they've got these independent groups. They're the same groups, as you noted earlier, that did the swift voting of John Kerry. You better believe there is a ton of money swimming out there for these groups, and they're going to launch the nastiest campaigns and then give John McCain or anybody else the ability to say, oh, we didn't have anything to do with it. It's coming. And a smart Barack Obama has got to get out in front of it.
Juan, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Pat.
Juan Williams, political analyst for NPR and for Fox News, his piece in the Wall Street Journal on Friday urging Barack Obama to make another race speech, this one directed to his own issues and his own shortcomings. Do you agree? Do you need to hear more from Barack Obama? Are there parts of the nation that need to hear more about race from Barack Obama as well? Give us a call at 866-893-5722. The question about Reverend Wright and his comments that have dropped Barack Obama's poll numbers in certain parts of the country. And as Juan Williams pointed out, there are people waiting out there to pounce on Barack Obama on these issues, has, according to Juan Williams, made it a necessity for Barack Obama to address these matters. 866-893-KPCC in Porter Ranch. Greg is calling. Greg, thanks for your call.
Yes, I'm calling. I would like to say that if Barack Obama brings the issue up again, it'll only be used as a wedge issue by the Conservative Party from now until November. And I'm somewhat disappointed that Juan Williams would say that he should re-bring this issue back into the eye of the media so that the Republican Party can continue to replay and bring up those speeches again from Reverend Wright and from the other priest. And it would only be used as a wedge issue to take the focus off of the economy, the Iraq war, the gas prices. I think with his speech in Philadelphia, he's already addressed the issue, and I don't think it would be in his best interest to revisit the issue again.
Greg, what should happen? What should the Obama campaign do if we see a swift voting campaign about him on race, on issues of the Reverend Wright?
If there is no doubt that we will see a campaign about Reverend Wright come up again. However, if he revisits it, he should revisit it from a standpoint like he did with the speech in Philadelphia, and just and try to continue to focus on the issues that the American people are concerned about, and hopefully through that they won't be able to continue to use it over and over again. Because if he revisits it, he's not going to get his full message out. But right now, there's really nothing he can do, because it's going to happen. They're going to try to swift vote him. But the American people have had so much. They've heard this so much. I think people are burned out of it. It probably won't even take hold the way it did the first time around, because people are tired of it.
Greg, thanks very much. Do you agree with Greg? Are Americans over this, and will they not put up with a swift boat style campaign dealing with Barack Obama on race issues, or does he need to say more? 866-893-KPCC is the number in Irvine. Lisa's on the line. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Pat. I think that Juan Williams is right to a degree that Barack Obama did not do enough in his speech to lay that question to rest. That speech was brilliant for what it was. But my husband and I, who are Obama supporters, are baffled as to why he was in that church for so long with such a radical stance and these bizarre, like almost urban legend beliefs being preached to people. I think that if he addresses it, he doesn't have to do this mea culpa speech. What he should do is sit down, do an in-depth interview with somebody in a very controlled setting, and he's, you know, very artful, and I think he could give us more of an explanation.
One of the criticisms of the speech in March in Philadelphia was it was very much third person, but it wasn't first person enough. Do you agree, Lisa?
I agree. If the purpose of the speech was to address his membership in that church, then it failed. In terms of a generic race relations speech, I think it was as perfect as it could get.
Lisa, thanks very much. Do you agree with Lisa, or do you think that Barack Obama has already said enough about race relations and his relationship with the Reverend Wright and that church? 866-893-5722. In the West Adams District, Bill's on the line. Bill, go ahead.
Hey, Pat. Thank you so much for taking my call. Frankly, I think Juan Williams has drunk the Kool-Aid of Fox News for far too long. He absolutely asked and answered the question, and artfully. It was a brilliant speech in Philadelphia. And what I want to know is, where's the John McCain speech on race? We haven't heard a peep out of him, especially when his preachers that he went after, he sought the endorsement of Reverend Parsley and Reverend Hagee, brought up Hitler and the whole nine yards. This is not a one-sided conversation, and I think if Obama answers this again, then it's going to have to be McCain as well.
I think Bill, I think McCain has already disavowed the endorsements of those two men of the cloth. What we're talking about is Juan Williams' piece in the Wall Street Journal on June 6th, saying that Barack Obama needs to give another speech about race to get ahead of the advertising images sure to be circulated by his opponents that link him to outrageous racial rhetoric and fears that he's open to the radical left wing. Does he need to make another speech dealing with the Reverend Wright and some of his old ties? 866-893-5722. Or has he had enough? Has he said enough already about these relationships? 866-893-KPCC for your calls. In Santa Monica, Charles is calling. Charles, go ahead.
Hi, Pat. To become the first black president, Obama has to struggle with the same kind of faith, the same kind of moral struggle that's faced this country at the other times when there have been these huge steps forward in race relations. The Civil War brought up maybe the first huge moral struggle for everyone in the country. The second time, the Civil Rights Movement of the 60s, a huge moral struggle once again for everyone. And to think that Obama can become the first black president without a similar kind of earthquake in American society is, I think, naive. So, yes, he does have to address it again. I don't think it's, I think it's a mistake to think it has to be narrowed down to the Reverend Wright issue. I think that race is inherent in our culture and will not go away so easily. So I think it does need to be addressed time and time again. I think it otherwise will rear its head come November.
Charles, thank you very much for your call. Juan Williams, the NPR analyst and a commentator for Fox News, in the June 6th Wall Street Journal, is writing that Barack Obama needs to say more about race, specifically his relationship with the Reverend Wright, among other things, because certainly the criticisms will be coming from the other side, from swift boat style groups bringing up again and again that relationship. How should Barack Obama address them? Should he make another speech? Should he make many other speeches in order to, as Juan Williams wrote, preempt the advertising images that are sure to come? The heart of Mr. Obama's problem, Juan Williams writes, is that he risks being defined by the Reverend Wright and Father Flegger. Is this something that Barack Obama needs to get in hand immediately? Give us a call at 866-893-5722. You can play a bit of a campaign advisor here. What do you think? 866-893-KPCC. In Cheviot Hills, Marion is calling. Marion, thanks. Go ahead.
Hello, thank you. Yes, my perspective is that Senator Obama is running as an American and a Democrat. And I think the attempt to lasso him in as a spokesperson and an apologist for the black community is a burden that he does not have to carry. And I think the party is very well aware of what's coming, and hopefully they will deal with it. But I'm very concerned also at the messenger who came on today, Juan Williams. You know, I really think that it was a very destructive and biased opinion. So that's all I have to say.
So Marion, let me get this clear. You don't think that Barack Obama should bring up race or racial issues at all in his campaign?
Well, let me ask you why. Why? He's already dealt with it twice.
But race is at the core of so many problems in this country. Can he really get away with saying nothing about them?
I think he has to incorporate it into his campaign as appropriate. It's one aspect. And I think it can be incorporated in a positive way. You know, as he's a pioneer, the first really serious African-American to reach this point in the United States. And I think it's just fantastic. So I don't see him having to be a stand-up for the black community. He's not running. He's an American.
Marion, thanks very much for your call. In Long Beach, Gary commented that Barack Obama is mixed race, and thus he should present himself as that and stop being the first black candidate, given that he is African-American and white, as he points out. In South Los Angeles, Barbara is calling with her advice for Barack Obama and Juan Williams. Barbara, go ahead.
Yes, I think that, first of all, Juan Williams has been at Fox a little bit too long, and their ideology is rubbing off on him, and we know that's a conservative Republican ideology. Second, by raising a defense, Barack Obama will make himself look defensive. First of all, John McCain has some issues that he needs to answer. He voted against the King holiday. He has a whole history of racist actions that actually impact people's lives, not just a pastor's speech in the church. And second, this whole issue that needs to be addressed. For 40 years, the Tuskegee experiment was performed on black men. So the Reverend raising an issue of black people being utilized by the United States government in experiments is true. So it's not something that he just dreamed up. This has actually happened within our history. But you know what? All of those issues are American issues. They're not Barack Obama's issues. So if the swift boaters want to bring it, then let them bring it. I'm quite sure Mr. Obama will know how to take care of it.
Barbara, thank you very much for your call. In Pasadena, it's Jervy on the line. Hello, Jervy.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I would say that I think that the race question is overinflated in the United States. I mean, the media overinflates it. Compared to other countries, compared to Britain, France, Germany, we are a much more tolerant and considerate and polite culture when it comes to issues of race. And I think the reason Barack Obama is in the position he is right now is because of that tolerance and foresightedness of the American people. I think Juan Williams has a problem, as other people said. He seems to want to ferment racial tension more than he wants to pose questions that actually, I guess, enlighten and shed some light on the issue.
Juan Williams' piece in the Wall Street Journal last Friday talked about the need for Barack Obama to make yet another speech on race to make personal points about distancing himself from the Reverend Wright and some of the more extreme and controversial positions that he had held, that it needs to be done in order to preempt advertising images and campaigns that will certainly come against Barack Obama through the general campaign. Jervie, how then do you think Barack Obama should respond if someone tries to swift boat him on racial issues?
I think what he needs to say is look at the failed policies of this administration, $6 per gallon gasoline, a failed economy, a perpetual war. You're talking about race while the country is burning. I think that's what he needs to do.
Jervie, thanks very much. And in Los Angeles, let's see, Mac is on the line. Mac, thanks for your call.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say, I think that Obama can talk till he's blue in the face about race, but the people that have a problem with it are never going to hear the inspiring things that he says. It's a non-issue for the people that have a problem with his race. I think if it's going to be addressed, it should be addressed by his surrogates, because McCain's never going to bring up race. Only his surrogates and the PACs and the 527s are.
So you think that the opponent should match the opponent? It shouldn't be the guy at the top of the ticket speaking to somebody that's way down the political food chain?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's only going to be addressing the bottom feeders that think race is an actual issue, when, as a caller previous said, he's running as an American, not as, you know, just for the black community. He's running for all of us.
Mac, thanks very much for your call. In Redlands, Martin is on the line. Martin, go ahead.
Hi. I wholly agree with the majority of callers. This issue is something that if swift voters want to bring it up, fine. Let's talk about Barack Obama's true cultural background and his true diversity with as an American. Let's also hear more about the issues and less about what Fox News wants to characterize as where he's coming from.
And, Martin, what do you think he should do if we do see swift boat attacks come up against him on these matters?
I think he should be presidential, as he's been throughout the campaign, and should say that he's already addressed the issue, that if there are any more questions, that people should dig deeper into his true background and his upbringing and start talking about what matters, which is the economy and the war in Iraq and how we get out of where we are.
Martin, thanks very much. And in Long Beach, Linda's calling. Linda, go ahead.
Hi, Pat. I agree with the callers who say that Barack Obama has addressed this issue eloquently, completely. And there are people in this country who are not going to vote for a black person, no matter who it is. And for him to continue to apologize or act defensive is not going to make any difference at all to those people.
Linda, thanks very much. We're talking about Barack Obama and whether he needs to make another speech to address racial issues to get out ahead of the campaign. This is Juan Williams' argument in a Wall Street Journal. You heard from Juan, and we heard from you. Thank you all very much for your calls. This is 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio.